So today we are so excited to have Jennifer Shaw-Sweet joining us on the pod today. She was one of the speakers at Digitex London and she was representing LinkedIn. And we just got the most amazing feedback off of her session. So she was talking about the CMO scorecard, what marketing leaders need to know, and going a bit deeper in things like brand advertising, the power of good creative, the power of top of the funnel advertising. And it was really just what a lot of people in the room needed to hear. She also just had the most amazing energy and everybody loved her. So we had to get her on the podcast. So we're absolutely delighted to have her here today. So welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to see you all.
For sure. So yeah, you could maybe start off by telling us just a little bit about your journey today. I know you've worked in lots of other agencies and you do lots of work at LinkedIn and especially on the B2B side. Lots of our listeners today will be involved more on the B2B side of marketing and just need to hear this content. So tell us a bit more about your personal marketing journey so far.
Okay, so I originally qualified as a lawyer and then switched very quickly to working in agency as a sort of like, I just decided I didn't want to spend my 20s doing anything as boring as law. And so through that, I ended up working in a couple of quite strategic agencies. So I worked very quickly in M&C Saatchi and then I got poached to McCann onto their global grad scheme, which was a sort of trial idea, which went through across all of their holding companies. And it was very foundational in the way that my career developed afterwards, because it meant that I was initially working in international and also an international work. Once you start working on like global brands, global brand teams, it tends to be very strategic very quickly. Like the discussions aren't about necessarily the immediate activation, but they're always about why, what we understand about like large groups of customers, large moves, and often about business relationships. So it felt very B2B very fast, in particular because I was working on new business very early in my career. And so pitching, understanding how the business makes money, understanding how you fit organizations with other organizations. It is a bit of a like dating game when you try to bring organizations together and pitching. And then from that, from McCann's working across these big global brands, working in different companies in the IPG group as well, like having experience working in the CRM teams at MRM at the time, Universal McCann, doing that kind of work experience across all of them on the grad scheme. I then moved into account management, as everyone does, like the account exec role. I did a couple of really big projects launching campaigns and brands in other countries, living in Peru, living in Malaysia. So got a really good international experience from that. And then from that worked, I moved after a few years to Grey, where I then took on much more of a new business role and also worked on Procter & Gamble, learned a lot from just being able to be immersed into all of these different companies, these different company cultures. That's when I first worked on Master Foods as well, on Pedigree and on their chocolate business. And then from that, a number of other agencies. Have you seen, if anyone wants to join my LinkedIn, link with me on LinkedIn. But from there, I went and I worked at FCB. I then worked at Abbott Mead Vickers. I then worked at Saatchi & Saatchi's and then JWT. But consistently working on very big brands on a very sort of strategic account leadership role. I'm really interested in strategy. And then on the sly in the background doing academic study. And so from that, from my role at JWT, where I was leading on the global, by then I think I'd finished HSBC, I was leading the global chocolates business on Nestle. I got a call from my former boss, Jan Schwartz, who is an incredible creature in the world of marketing, saying that he was setting up a think tank at LinkedIn and it was going to be using LinkedIn's data, using external relationships with academics to create a think tank that would study and write the I guess the book that doesn't exist on B2B marketing. So if any of us go to university and study marketing, God forbid, go and study something more fun. But like, if you did go to university and study marketing, well done. It's very easy to find a marketing course. You could, if you want to just do Mark Ritson's marketing course, but there are lots of marketing courses out there, but there are very few about B2B because there are very, and therefore there are very few academics specializing in B2B. There are very few textbooks. There are very few papers on pure B2B marketing that are rigorous academic papers. There are lots of opinions, but opinions without data are pretty useless. You can't bet the farm on that. And so the purpose of the B2B Institute then became to write, while we were flying it, to use the metaphor of building the plane as you fly it, to create as we were flying it, a textbook, a living textbook on B2B marketing. And so that's the nature of the studies that we do. The nature of the consultancy that we do is applying the models that we discover, the data that we discover, to B2B marketing. So I went from B2C, B2B, business relationships, all the way through to B2B study of B2B marketing and how it can be more business impactful.
That's fantastic. And working at agency on some of these huge brands will have really shown you in that kind of real world experience the power of brand and investing in brand. And it's not always about the performance, which then sets you up for now. Excuse me.
Yeah, and at various times I got like seconded into my customer's marketing department. So I've worked as a marketer in about 4 different companies, literally just by covering like everything from maternity cover to literally. So for the example of when I lived overseas, it was pretty much because 2 companies were merging and they needed someone neutral to sit in the middle and make the logistics happen. And so it was easier to bring in the agency chick to do that than who was a peacemaker rather than anyone having taken sides. So I think that's the other side of it, is like agency-wise, you get to experience so many different companies, so many different businesses. You have a business relationship with them, but you also sometimes get to broker some of the other relationships as well.
Yeah. And you learn so much, I think. Like, you know, we as an agency are always really trying to understand, like, really put yourself in your client's shoes, you know, when they're maybe under pressure or dealing with something. And I think doing that sort of secondment piece into the client lets you see, okay, this is what they're actually dealing with, or this is, you know, the number of hats that they're wearing in the team. So I think we can all benefit a huge amount by spending time in each other's shoes. So very interesting dynamic to do that. And what did you love about agency? I'm obviously running agencies, so I'm always interested. What do you love and what do you not love that you're not doing now?
The thing that you will always love about agency is agency culture. The nature of the incredibly smart, intelligent people you get to work with all the time, this sort of refreshed talent. I love the variety of agency work that you work across. And so one of the lovely things about my job now is I work across 42 different clients at any time. In agency world, I would be working across, you know, when I was running Nestle, it was like 125 countries, about 6 or 7 different brands. That meant huge numbers of brand people, huge numbers of teams, lots of creatives, like the culture of creativity, constantly challenging, the sort of the cut and thrust of agency life is always really exciting. And selling ideas is actually a real luxury. Like, what an ephemeral, weird thing to be selling, but at the same time, what an incredibly transformative thing to be selling all the time. The ability to turn around someone's business, save the jobs of employees, of colleagues. Like, the reality of what agencies deliver is more than an increase in sales. It's often like resilience on the balance sheet. And I think I really enjoyed that. I think the thing I didn't enjoy was the money and the fact that agency life tends to be champagne lifestyle, lemonade wages, and the hours, my God, the hours that we used to work. Like, it was totally normal to have a 96-hour week in some of the agencies I worked in. And I remember, you know, 1 year, like, never having a bank holiday, having maybe 3 weekends in the whole year, because we were, especially as the pitch bitch, like, you were constantly pitching, preparing, checking strategy, making sure everything was perfect, all the way up to reporting into the global CEO and having to have meetings with her, you know, in family time. And not, their family time didn't really exist in agency life. And I think that's the real, the unseen pressure of agency.
Oh, definitely. I think high pressure is okay, but not for a sustained period of 10 years or something like that. I think it just can swallow you up. So yeah, no, definitely don't recommend 96-hour weeks for anybody.
No. And I don't recommend that as a for anyone in an agency. I would say don't accept that as like the terms. I think I was working in a very extreme conditions.
Yeah, but you learned a lot, and I'm sure extremely resilient as a result of that. Exactly. So tell me about then maybe one piece of advice that maybe sticks with you from that time, or from, you know, earlier, somebody gave you, a mentor, or just something that really resonates that you still kind of hold on to today.
I think there are a couple of like planners that I worked with. In fact, almost every agency I had like a planning mentor, like a strategy mentor. So for like even the beginning, like McCann Erickson, John Fowler was just like an iconic planner. He's the guy who essentially created and sustained MasterCard Priceless over the last few decades. Like, what a legend. And so I think the key thing that I got huge amounts of like amazing advice from each of those relationships all the way through. Like just John Fowler, John Lowry, like people like James Miller at AMV. Almost every single planner at JWT, because it was such a planner heavy agency. And I think from that it was very much around, what is the role of the agency as custodian for the client, as the actual the voice of reason, the voice of sense, the ability to come in and represent your category audience, really understand, have real insight into what they're thinking, but also have the vision to know what next and have an eye on the future. You can be told only so much by history and by the data. And at one point you have to be looking at the marketplace and the context and what next. And I think the other thing I learned very much was from people like Tamara Ingram, which is, it is always the detail that's going to get you. So you have to know your customer's business better than anyone else. You need to know, I know for Tam, it's things like, you need to know your share price, you need to know the price point, you need to know what they're indexing this week, all the Procter & Gamble stuff, that rigor, the detail of marketing is really important. And I think the other thing that I've always learned from my agency experience is the power of inspiration, that you should never leave a meeting without a next action, but that next action should be inspired. It should have energy behind it, and it should be meaningful to the business, to the future of the business. If the next action is to write a contact report and send a bill, you said, I can swear on this, you've fucked up. Yeah. Because if everyone in the room isn't excited when you leave the room, then you're not going to get as much done. And it's going to feel like hard work. And that's not the point of walking into an agency. You walk into an agency for 90% inspiration, 10% perspiration.
Yeah. And making your clients' lives easier. And just as you say, that attention to detail. If the share price is down, everyone's going to be a bit stressed out, and they're maybe not easy, you know, they're not able to look at all of the things that you're talking about. So trying to take some of that pain away for them, get them excited and think about the emotion that you're actually delivering to your clients, rather than just, you know, whatever the numbers are. And that's, you know, something I think that we hold dearly, is people will forget all of the numbers over the period of time that you're working. The next year, no one's going to remember something unless they go look it up. It's, how did they feel? Did they feel that sense of inspiration or trust or whatever it is that you're looking to get? So great advice, and thanks for sharing.
I think the other piece of advice I'd say to agencies right now, and I think this is one of my rants. I did say I have a few rants at the moment, and it's get paid. Okay.
Yeah.
So as an agency, don't work for free, get paid, be able to justify your number instantly. You shouldn't walk into a room as a suit without knowing the hours that have been worked on any piece of business, on any piece of work. And you shouldn't pitch an idea without knowing the cost of it. And I think that actually that business rigor has become more pronounced and more important over the last few years. And we're so busy chasing our tail to get paid by the to get the client that you need to remember that the client needs to also pay you.
That is such a good point, and something that we've gone through recently is like, I think you end up, you win the big client and that's amazing, we're going to give them the 11-star customer experience and we want to deliver that, but then that can cross over into, okay, we're basically doing all this extra consultancy work for free for them because we want to impress them, we want to keep them happy, but then that just kind of keeps growing and growing, and all of a sudden you're a completely different company, you know, from what you started out to do. Yeah, so
you're not doing what you're good at, you're doing what someone else is good at, and actually it's costing you more, it'll cost you more hours.
No, we've just gone through that, and it's having the discipline and the confidence, I think, that takes a bit of time to build, to say to the clients, we actually shouldn't be spending our time on here, we can do it, but it's going to cost you a wee bit more money for us to go do that, and all agreeing that up front rather than this kind of incremental customer service that then blends into something else. So yeah, it's a line to manage, but I think everyone's getting a bit better at it, or the clients are more accepting of it once you kind of, but you need to set that boundary and have the confidence to stick to it. So yeah, totally with you on pay the agencies. Great. Okay, so let's get into the scorecard. CMO scorecard is a brilliant piece of research that was done by you guys over at LinkedIn, and it's just been such a refreshing piece of content. So maybe you could give us a bit of background. Where did you think the need came from? We know that there's been just really limited consumer insights, I think, in marketing. So yeah, give us a bit of background. Where did it come from? What kind of gap in the market does it fill? And yeah, what are you super proud of from that bit of research?
So we've been running a consultancy program with our biggest clients for a few years now, probably about 3 years. And it's called the Edge Program. The consultancy program, one of the outputs for each customer is a CMO scorecard, is a scorecard on how well the advertising inputs are performing, the media performance that we see on the platform, and then also creative performance, how are we seeing the creative landing, what could the customer do better? So the whole thing is presented as a, you know, this is how you're tracking, this is how everyone else tracks, what could you do better, what are you doing really well, what can you report onto the business? And then we were able, with the collaboration with clients, to also construct or work out how that was also impacting their outputs. And we could start to see really strong indicators on the platform of how the media was performing, how responsiveness was coming through, real responsiveness. Now, during that time, we had this, and the reason that we created that methodology was because we could see our largest customers struggling with justifying their brand spend. And I think this resonates everywhere. The reason being, from the very first publication that the B2B Institute did, which was with Les Burnett and Peter Field, about how B2B brands grow, how brands grow, the publication landed on this issue of the 6-month rule, that you don't really see the effects of brand in the first 6 months that you're spending on brand. Very few people have been able to measure that. Now, we could all sit there and go, okay, you can't measure the first 6 months of brand. Or you could say, how are we going to measure brand? Now, on LinkedIn, our clients really hold us to account. My God, they want a lot of detail to prove that the advertising's working. And so they look at this within the scope of performance marketing. They're looking at reactivity and proximity to sale. And so in performance marketing, the data exists. We almost have we definitely have too much data on what happens in the last mile before you hit a sale. And there's so much focus on that data that we overweigh the importance of it in the entire customer journey. And we want to rebalance that, because we know that brand advertising grows your brand, and that performance marketing, essential performance ABM marketing, can't physically grow the brand because it's limited by the number of customers that it's able to reach. If you can't reach more people, you can't sell to more people. So how do we help? The challenge was, how do we use the data that we have available in the consultancy program to prove to our customers, to their, not even to them, because they know it's true, they can see the results intuitively, but let's go beyond intuition. We're not astrologers, we're marketers. So how do we go beyond, you know, what may be right, and we may all know is right, but actually to be able to show the numbers that are right. And that's where in brand marketing, we were able to hit on these measures of being able to show impact on responsiveness to ABM. So we actually are still using the ABM data, but actually we can see between the people that have experienced brand and the people that haven't, we can see the improvement in response rates. That we were also able to see it in sales response rates, in the outreach for the sales department. My God, they love those figures, because like the guys in sales are like, anything to help me. In particular, when they're bit large B2B SaaS sales organizations really have that, you know, pain of sales, the pain of outreach, the pain of the initial conversation. Can we help that with brand? Yes, we can. We can show, we can prove better response rates from the people you're outreaching to if they've been exposed to brand advertising. And then the sort of other area beyond the sales funnel, where we've got a lot of data as LinkedIn, we're kind of lucky to have a sort of sales section to the platform, is that we were also able to show it in talent, which in my view starts to reflect how you're perceived in the category, how you're perceived as a brand. You don't just like a brand you apply for a job from, you really love them. You're willing to jump from your existing supporting your family and friends and supporting buying your home from one organization to another. Like the amount of faith someone joining your organization is showing is enormous. So we were able to look at these sort of three measures as big proof points for the fact that brand is working, and the sensitivity of them is much more short term. You don't see that necessarily over 6 months, you see it over the first 3 months of a brand campaign. And that means that we are shortening the time frame of proof for customers, so we're able to help them to prove that the advertising is working. And this became a paper because we realized that this methodology, these models, could be used to help the whole industry. It's not just about using this methodology that we've developed very conveniently on LinkedIn, but actually that this methodology should be a higher standard of proof that we should ask everyone for. And if you're able to create or understand the ecosystem around your brand, then you're also able to create a sort of a wider proof point, or a wider proof that brand is working. That's a very long answer, sorry.
It's fascinating, and I think gives some tangible things that people can do without panicking too much about the brand spend, because it's such a mindset shift for many brands. But actually, if you can show that over a period of 3 months, and if it can go to support your employer brand and everything else that you're trying to do, then you know it's absolutely worth its weight in gold. So yeah, I think it's an education piece to do that. And as you say, the data for B2B just wasn't really there, so now it's finally there that people can actually see. And can you expand a little bit on the 95/5 rule and what that would mean, and how people can actually use that in their marketing today?
Yeah, I use it in two ways. So the 95/5 rule isn't from us, it's from the Ehrenberg Bass Institute that we partner with on our research. And it looks at the cycling in of buying behavior. So no one is buying from you all the time, unless you're selling chocolate bars. People don't buy at a very high frequency, especially actually in B2B, where they tend to buy large contracts infrequently. So when you work out it's really helpful to work out what percentage of your audience is likely to be buying in any buying period. It manages your expectations, it manages the finance department's expectations, but it also gives you a realistic view on how many people are capable of responding to your advertising or capable of buying from you. And on average, it works out as around 5% of your market are in market at any time, and 95%, and by any time we normally mean per quarter, which is tends to be how we're all targeted as well, or remunerated. And then the 95% are in the remaining quarters, of the remaining five, so about 19 quarters. So when you look at the data, the likelihood of people coming into becoming a buyer, what you're looking at is in the short term, people who are making a decision about buying, evaluation decisions. And then at the long term, the 95%, people who are generally mulling around doing their own business, being a human being. Now, that's really interesting, because when they're doing that, they're in a completely different mindset, aren't they? They're not evaluating a purchase because they don't know a purchase is coming along. And most people in most organizations don't know when they're going to need to fix a problem or when a buying situation is going to suddenly happen. You do have that with RFPs, but even then, most of the time, anyone even involved with the RFP, it kind of shocks them that it's suddenly arrived in the next sort of 3 months. But the influence on that tipping point moment becomes really important, because the more strong you are as a brand in your category, the more likely you are to be thought of in association with the buying situation and getting into that consideration set for the 5% period. So if you're a strong brand, even in a weak category, in fact, if you're a strong brand in a weak category, amazing, you're more likely to be thought of. But if you're a brand in a category, then you're thought of in association with a buying situation. If you're in a commoditized category where no brands are strong, then people just search for a solution. They don't search for a brand. They don't know of a brand that defines, interestingly, their understanding of the category. So my advice to anyone thinking about their brand advertising is to think about how you're not writing an education on your products and services, you're writing an inspiration into why your brand should be remembered when people come into a moment of need. And that leads to very different creative. If you think about how to become memorable, spreading yourself thin, as you're going to have to be spread across 95% of the category, unpredictably, what 95% are we talking about? Then you're going to have to think about how you become really sticky in the brains of consumers. You're going to have to think about how you're memorable, how your memories are associated with emotion. You remember things you're more emotionally connected to. So you need to use emotion. You need to be a bit inspiring or sticky, you're going to have some reason to stand out from everyone else in the category. And ideally, you're remembered for something that is going to be triggered by that moment of need. So you're probably going to have some kind of category association that connects you to why you should be remembered when that moment comes in. And the moment comes in, you know, someone breaks the photocopier. It could be any reason that it comes in that unexpected trigger moment happens. And then your ABM works. Then you can have all the evaluation information and everything else. But I like to look at things like in the 95% period, what are people searching for when they're searching for solutions? What are people associating with the category? And we look at things. We've done a number of studies on category entry points to understand what you need to be remembered for. So have a look on the B2B Institute website. You can see them. There's some on, we've got some stuff on cloud, business banking is a big one at the moment, and also on hardware, computer hardware. So loads of different areas of study around category entry points, but really understanding what those motivators are should help people prioritize where they see that. But the other side of it that I look at is financial. Mm-hmm. How do you use that 5% calculation, 5% of your marketplace is in market spending money, and therefore times that by 19 is probably the value that you currently have as your share of the whole category, your likely revenue if you carry on advertising as you're doing. Now, we don't want just the likely revenue if we carry on as we're doing. That would be lazy. It wouldn't be growing. And therefore, we would be vulnerable to our competitors. So we also need to be thinking about how do you prospect into the category and earn more than the next 5% that you're due. You want to be increasing the share of mind so that you're getting 6% next quarter or whatever, yeah, as you prospect into the full value of the category, not just your percentage. And that's where I do quite a lot of revenue calculations against growth for customers, so that they can actually go to their finance team and say, this is how much I want to make next year. This is what the value I would expect to see from running the advertising would be in the following year. So we think about the 95.5, we think about excess share of voice or share of voice calculations. And we also think about funnel calculations. If I create this many opportunities to win, this many wins should be happening. And I think that then leads us to very much more persuasive discussions about the business, about the future of the business.
Yeah, That's great. And I think if you can tie that to tangible numbers, it's an easier sell. So if you become top of mind for the 95%, then actually that makes your number of people in market more likely to buy by the time they get to that buying cycle. And also, I guess you're always trying to grow the 95% as well, because we're investing in the brand, and then that should kind of compound as well in terms of reach that you're actually delivering. So amazing. And yeah, if you've got any resources in those calculations, I think everybody would be extremely interested. And then just going back to your point that you made earlier about being memorable and the types of creative, you know, we see so many advertising messages in a day, and actually the risk of not being seen is bigger than the cost of being seen, and it's and you're spending in that awareness piece. So could you talk a little bit about any learnings you've got on the creative side, any examples that spring to mind, or just what B2B brands can do that's a bit more exciting than maybe some of the stuff that you might see at the moment?
Yeah, so there are definite pitfalls that B2B brands fall into. So I would avoid those initially. I think the biggest ones are sort of lists of product attributes. It means it's really hard to remember anything. We've done some lovely research that shows if you have three things to remember from an ad, you're less likely to remember the whole brand than if you just have one. So really simplifying what you're trying to say. I think the other thing is this category association, like why should you be remembered as a reason to buy? And I think the other thing is differentiation. That's a really big one. And I think Jenny Romaniak's work on distinctive brand assets goes into how you create visually advertising and even sonically advertising that is easy to associate with the brand. And having a really strong idea of how to simplify that list of distinctive brand assets so that you're always putting your money behind how you make yourself the most memorable is really important. In B2B, the color blue, I think, reassures every company that they are a B2B brand, but destroys distinctiveness like nothing else. And I say that as LinkedIn, a blue brand, but it is astonishing how many blue brands there are out there and how much it stands in the way of memorability. Whereas you look at things like the most memorable brands in B2B, we did a study on it. If you want to have a look, it's on the site. But we did a study on distinctiveness, and in particular, you can see like AWS and Microsoft doing really, really well because they have alternative, not just because they have alternative colors, they also have enormous spends. So you can't just win by the creative, you've got to put the money behind it. But the creative should be distinctive and memorable and iconic, ideally, and really think about the iconography of the brand rather than variety. And I think that's the other thing in B2B. As marketers, we're so absorbed in our marketing. God, it's lovely, isn't it? Creating like loads of new toolkits and really beautiful campaigns. And it's so exciting. It's so exciting. It's why we all come to work. So never underestimate it. Agencies should never underestimate the excitement of a campaign, of like creating a campaign for any marketer. But that said, aiding memorability happens through repetition. It doesn't happen through novelty. And so much as it's nice to stand out and be novel, we need to help people remember us. And that comes through familiarity. And so I think sticking with the same campaign, once you've found a good one, once you've created a really wonderful suite of work, ideally a very shortlisted suite of the work that works, then really, really sticking with it over the long term is proven across all of our research. We did some beautiful work with System One, just looking at, you know, familiarity and how that works. And I think that's the biggest thing that is missed in B2B, is that I've done a lot of judging of different awards, and I often find people love to award the biggest toolkit rather than the strongest toolkit. And it's a real mistake as an industry that we seem to love, you know, as many different shelf wobblers, and in B2B it would be like event paraphernalia and brochures and like all this, and the downloadable whatever PDF, and it's like none of those things help you be remembered. Saying what you said last year will probably help you be remembered better. And I think as agencies, it is where this whole thing of being like the custodian of the brand is so important, because we can be the ones that remind our client, that we can, agency people can be the ones that remind clients who they are. who their brand is, what it is, what is essential versus what is nice to have, and how well you're remembered. And that consistency is where MasterCard Priceless is a lovely example. It's totally not B2B. But even things like on the logo, don't change the logo. Please God, don't change the logo. Don't change the, not again. And then also like, don't change the, people spend so much time on end lines. No one's ever remembered an end line for a B2B. Yeah. I think the only one they've ever remembered is IBM. IBM's end line around, if it's not IBM, you know, you wouldn't trust it. And it's just like, none of these things are serving you well. What serves you well? Consistency, simplicity.
Yeah. And also I think, adding, you know, that consistency. And if you can have something like a benchmark around what emotion do you actually want your end customers to feel, whether that's winning or whether it's confidence or whatever that thing is, and you almost have that as the benchmark for all of the creative that goes out. So it can be memorable and you're doing something exciting, but actually you've got that kind of consistent test every time something goes out. So you're creating that feeling along with the brand consistency. And I think that gets missed in the B2B side as well, that, you know, on the consumer side, it's quite strong. On B2B, it's like, okay, what emotion are we delivering? Does that piece of copy deliver it? Does that video actually deliver it? So you get a bit of the kind of fun, sexy stuff, but not lose the consistency piece. Yeah. I think that's really important too.
And there's a huge emotional range in B2B. We deny it. We tell everyone that B2B decision makers are sensible, and they just want reassurance that they're making the right B2B decision. And they do want that. Like, there's a real, the team have published some really lovely pieces on the fear of fucking up. Like, the fear of making the wrong decision for your company is far greater than your fear of not making a decision at all. That's really worrying if you're trying to sell. But actually, the emotions in B2B can be really, really broad, and are very, very peer related and are high emotion. Like, everyone has very high emotion about keeping their job, rest assured. And so, for sure. The decision maker buying a $100 million contract in B2B in construction or something, that is a highly emotional decision involving a lot of emotional people who feel incredibly responsible for the money that they're spending. That emotion needs a vent sometimes. But how you use emotion to drive memorability, maybe that you actually do use humor to reframe fear. Like, is there a way that you can do that? Like, is there a way that you can use emotion to reframe the challenge? I think that that's also the other side of it. Like, sometimes the right answer is the opposite emotion.
Oh, exactly. And I think IBM's internal, not the external tagline they use, but everyone said, you'll never get fired for buying IBM. That wasn't what they wanted to go out as, but that was the human side of it, is like, I'm not going to make a mistake if the servers go down and, you know, everyone's screaming about it. And you say it's IBM, everyone goes, oh, well, who'd have thought IBM would mess up, as opposed to, oh, we used this little local supplier and the servers have gone down. Why did you use them? You know, exactly. So I think it's that fear piece, and I like that, bringing humor to, we are all human and we make mistakes and these are our fears. You know, let's acknowledge that and use that in our marketing. So yeah, absolutely on board with that. So let's just talk a little bit about balancing the budget. So in terms of results, we can start to show how that's actually improving and how brand speaks volumes about, you know, maybe our slightly medium to longer term goals. How would you attribute a budget if you're thinking about funnel stages, maybe, which is something that's really common in marketing? What's your kind of feel for how you would allocate that budget for long and short term goals?
Before the pandemic, we were really obsessed with like allocating budget in B2B. It's around 50-50 was the kind of, the case studies would suggest that was the optimum way of doing it. It was about 55% to brand and 45% to performance or ABM. And then during the pandemic, what we saw was a rising importance of brand. So the further you were away from your decision makers, the more you wanted to lean on a strong brand as like the rationale, as a really good kind of like reassurance that you're making the right decision in a B2B decision. And we could see that in high online research and selling. Peter Field wrote a really lovely paper and did a really lovely study on it. In luxury brands, it's 80% brand, 20% performance. So really astonishingly heavy on brand. I think that probably right now it's a mixture. I think we're probably looking at around 70 to 60% brand. I think things have settled into having to really create good rationales for spending. But it really depends what category you're on and whether you're in a strong growth category or a stagnating category. If you're in a category which has currently got low sales but high likelihood of future sales, so one that's suffering from the current economic climate, then investing in current sales to the point of it not being sort of remembered in the long term is not going to, in the long term, help your business as much as gaining share is. And so I think in that situation, if you are in a currently stagnant but likely to grow in the future category, which would be there's quite a few categories like that at the moment, then I would be really thinking about how I get the long tail of customers into my orbit. So I'd be thinking about heavy reach into outliers to find any business that's out there, but also to be able to have gained the share, the level of awareness, of share of awareness or share of memorability, that when the category picks up again, you have more of the marketplace thinking of you. So we think of it as like a 99-1 equation, like 1% of the buying audience is currently buying, 99% are out there to be buying in the future. And it's one of the reasons why at the end of a downturn, you see these enormous kind of recovery, really fast recovery curves, because people are holding back a purchase that is needed. And so that's the point where brand is so powerful, because evaluation goes out the window. A purchase has been put off for like 3 years. We've all needed new laptops. Oh my God. So at that point, it's like, whatever brand we thought of over the last 3 years, that's the one we're going with. Like, Janet's just signed off the finances. Quick, go buy the laptops. We're all desperate. And so I think that thinking of it like that, thinking of it as an investment in future share, but also really connecting with the whole universe of customers more broadly, so that you're capturing the outlier buyers right now, is a really strong brand strategy. That said, in some sectors, if you look at healthcare, it's booming at the moment. So in that, then I would be looking at having a lot of conversion, because it's there's a lot of people coming in market.
That's really helpful to get those numbers. And what would you say? So some of our clients will be very large scale events. So say they're launching an event, maybe in Dubai, Saudi, and they will learn about and have to launch and have to make that event busy all within a 1 year cycle. So you've maybe realistically got 9 months to market the thing and get, you know, 200,000 people on site or something. So the brand is new, the event is new, but it has a pretty big performance target attached to it. How would you split a budget in that sense? And would you apply any sort of adjustment when you've got quite a compressed timeline, or is just... Yeah, I'd be interested to hear your take on that.
So yeah, I would do a sliding scale towards the date of the event. And in particular, I would be looking for the broadest reach, the furthest away from the event. In particular, because ticket sales, you want the confidence builder for your customer quite early on. So you want to be able to show we've got rid of half the tickets quite early on. And for that, I would be looking at a really broad footprint of people who are likely to attend an exhibit. And I would be looking at indicators of interest. So they might not commit until a certain deadline, but you can see indicators of registration or people putting it in their diaries, stuff like that. So that's where brand and the reason why people might want to travel to those events, if you're looking beyond your geography, which those really big events are expecting people to travel, I would be looking at that. So I would start off with the equivalent of brand for events, which is that broad outreach of possible attendees, possible and exhibitors and sponsors. And then as you get closer, I'd be looking more at performance, and I would definitely kind of split the spend that way, so that you ramp up your performance work much closer to the conversion date. But it also means that you've warmed up your audience before they're served the performance marketing. And that we can see is hugely advantageous. We can see up to 6 times better responsiveness from people who've been exposed to brand first. And that's because they're being contacted by someone who's perceivably famous. Like, it's perceivably a notorious thing that they should have heard of because they've seen the brand ad for it. They've seen the context. They've been given context to that approach, rather than it feeling like a sort of a random approach from God knows whatever.
Yeah,
it's certainly how we look at how I would look at events as a as someone who speaks at events as well. Is like, have I heard the event? Then I might go. Have I heard of the organizer? Then I might go, or I might present even. That I think that cut of the thinking about the experience is really important, but also on the prioritization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think the other thing we've learned with events is just, and this was pre-pandemic, but also after as well, is just the decision making for people is so much later and really, really compressed. So, you know, typically we would see a spike maybe 6 weeks out, 4 weeks out. Now it can be 1 to 2 weeks. People are like, there's just a feeling of we're not always sure what's going to happen, and you know, I might get too busy, and just that decision making is much later. So you do have to have invested in all of that brand spend. They've got confidence, they've, like you say, they've heard the speakers, they kind of know what's going on, and then you're just getting to that last mile of like, okay, I'm actually going to go because I've kind of had this ramp up. But it definitely creates a lot more pressure, I would say, for our clients, because we're like, it's fine, it's all going to come in, don't worry. And they're like, wow, I'm like 50% down registration. You're like, it's all fine. And usually 9 times out of 10 is
really being able to understand what the indicators of interest and the indicators of people being interested are. I think that's really important. And it does come down to having people, I would look at cycles of sign off for things like travel budgets and things as well. Like, if you think of most people are approved a T&E quarterly, that is going to affect their ability to attend. Those are the budgets that get cut really early. So really think about like how that's something that you can impact on, or how you're giving people the rationale for how this could be, you know, quite early on, what is the need that the event is answering for someone's business, rather than just general knowledge about the category. So it could be like, I've attended a bunch of businesses where I was leading sessions in breakouts because the people I was meeting in the breakouts were more valuable than the attending the whole conference. And I don't think that's unusual at all. A lot of it is the business is done in the conference, or at least the pitching is done in the conference, and it's all happening in a room, you know, at the side. And understanding how that can be facilitated and that's set up, and that is like a reason to attend in its own right, is I think things like that become really important when budgets are tight. Like, what is the rationalization? But the brand decided whether you were going to attend or not. Like, let's all be nice and cynical and truthful about why did you attend a global tech conference in Morocco? Because I knew that I was going to reach everyone. It was a huge opportunity for the whole of, to reach the African marketers. It wasn't because there were 3 meetings I was going to have in Morocco. Like, I was there for the brand. I was there for the overall, the overall thing. And so, yeah, I would be looking at that. And I think, I don't know, I used to do, for Shell, I used to do the air show, the Geneva air show. And for that as an event, you're kind of like really thinking about what the return on that investment is going to be. You're having to create the exhibitors, like having to create the cost of the stand, the transportation, all the printing of all the stuff that you need to take along. Oh my God, the barista making coffee for people on the stand, like all of that stuff. Faces. Yeah. Right. And how you measure, how can the event show how you can measure the ROI, becomes one of the biggest decision makers. And that's a performance marketing message. That is not a brand message. The brand message is, what a big, massive, amazing, glossy, fabulous show. And the only show in aviation in Europe, like, it's the one. So it isn't the only one, but it's a big one. And I think that counterpoint is really important, really thinking about how you balance those messages.
Yeah, and keeping that kind of ROI in the budget line as well for that marketing piece, that brand awareness piece, actually continues to give. So you get the performance metrics on the back of the event, but actually the being there, being visible, all of that stuff is your kind of intangible that, you know, just goes to speak to that spend later. Okay, one last thing before I get on to some of your advice for the future. So we find maybe when companies are setting their more strategic objectives, marketing isn't always up there. You know, they're maybe looking at the more sales side or the operations, but we feel that's starting to become part of the conversation. And one thing that we're seeing a lot is, how can we measure marketing effectiveness? How do we make marketing more productive? And it's starting to get a bit more attention from your kind of C-level executives. Yeah. Can you speak to that in terms of the research that you've been doing and the insights that you've got? And does that investment in brand actually support marketing effectiveness? And is there a specific time frame that you would see that over?
Yeah. So I definitely, well, I think we're shortening the time frame that you can see marketing effectiveness from. And that's because everyone's very impatient to be able to show it. And the sooner you're able to show the impact, that also the sooner you're able to get allies within C-suite. So it should no longer just be the CMO that goes in and talks about the importance of marketing. It should be the CMO, the CFO, the head of sales, at least, and then also the product people and the customer, you know, the customer services people. As many people as possible, in fact, should be talking about how they need help from marketing and how they need more marketing. And I think that's where marketing needs to be better at marketing internally, in actually really increasing understanding of the impact that marketing is making against all of those pillars of the business internally. Not just in how the company makes money, although we've got a lovely paper that you can read about that, but also about how everyone else's job is much easier when you have a well-known brand, a famous brand, or you're known notoriously within the category. It's really easy to sell stuff that you are famous for doing really well. And that's the job of marketing. So even down to distribution, like the distribution network is much easier if you have a strong brand because people want to stock you. And so I think that that's where I would be putting measurement. I wouldn't be putting, there's absolutely no point measuring the number of followers that you have on any platform, or the number of shares, or the number of likes, or all of those kind of things, because they aren't linked to performance. They aren't linked to the actual outcomes that impact your C-suite or impact even your shareholders. And so I would be looking at I would almost have like a line of measurement for everyone I want to be my ally on the board, and reporting a one pager every month to each of them that way, and having a methodology and a cadence for reporting the impact of marketing, and having it as a two-way conversation. So marketing can market itself, but it also has to have customer insight on its internal customers too, and really understanding what problems need fixing, and having a list of those problems on the eraser board in your office, your virtual office, is essential too. Because if you are fixing problems where they are the most acute, where they're impacting the business the most, and really judging actually where you're able to have the most impact internally, it's going to really help all of those conversations. Like the easiest conversation in the world is, can I have more budget, when the head of sales says, I need more marketing because I'm seeing the results in the sales. Like, here's the money. You know, if the money's exactly there, you can have it. And I think that that's the position we should be getting ourselves into as marketers, because we know it's true. We know that when marketing is done really well and it's reaching enough people, then everything else is easy. You make money.
I think I'm going to get that framed for the office, your quote, marketing makes everyone else's job easier. So yeah. I think I'm going to get that phrased. Amazing. Okay, so tell me then, just your kind of glimpse into the future. Where do you see B2B marketing headed over the next couple of years, or what are you most excited about?
I'm really excited about, in particular, I'm really excited about the fact that we are on a trajectory to have really strong brands in B2B. And it's not for the obvious reason, which is that the place to do B2B advertising is LinkedIn, and therefore there'll be more cash coming into LinkedIn. Although, let me reassure you, that is true. But where I'm really excited about it is I think that the stronger brands we have in B2B, the better products we'll have in B2B, because there will be differentiation and therefore price points. You'll be able to charge more for what you sell. And that will make more robust, resilient businesses that can invest in better in product development, creating better products and services. And in B2B, it pretty much affects all of us. Like, it affects how our society runs, how well we experience, you know, everything, infrastructure, all the way through to the photocopier, like all the way through to the kind of like ephemeral stuff. And it also is 50% of the economy. So I also think we will have stronger, financial security from it. And I think that that's underrated in the world at the moment, in our kind of general discussion at the moment. The other thing I am excited about is I am really excited about AI, and I'm excited about it for a really weird reason, probably quite a niche reason, which is that I think AI suits good thinkers. It suits intelligence, because you need to have very smart people instructing the AI. Otherwise, it's rubbish, like bad input, bad output. And so I think it's actually going to create more interesting, better jobs in B2B for people who have really engaged and really invested the time in understanding their category, their customer, but also what is out there. I think it's going to really suit creative people, for example, because they're going to have nuanced understanding of what they're asking the AI to do. And I also think, as long as we have an eye on it, like we have to be, and this is why you need senior people also involved, because there has to be a level of moral judgment going on, that we don't end up, not even fading to beige, but fading to extremity, then I actually think that we could free ourselves to do better work, not more work. And the danger of AI is that we end up just making more rubbish. And the opportunity of AI is that we evaluate better and make less but better stuff. And I think that that's a huge, the people who know the difference will win and will have the most successful businesses. And hopefully we'll also invest in training people are the best employees of the future. They will employ people for very different reasons. And the eradication of grunt work, it's a horrible phrase, but I've been a grunt, so I can say but the eradication of the grunt work, I think, will mean that we have more respectful conversations in our businesses. Yeah. And I really embrace that. I think that would be a really positive thing.
Yeah, I think that's a really good angle about the respectful conversations, and completely agree. I think it's upskilling the teams so they know what the capabilities are, and using AI for the jobs that we don't need to do anymore. And I think it's, you know, in the same way that we used to say, oh my goodness, like a search engine, like imagine the first time we all saw a search engine, think, yeah, oh, we're all going to get so stupid and we're not going to be able to do this and do that. But actually we can do tasks faster and better because we've got access to that. We don't need to go to a library and, you know, get all of that research. So actually, if we're open to creativity and new ideas, then we can just elevate what the level of types of work that we can actually do. So yeah, I think, you know, there's risks, of course, but any technological adventure, you're going to see that. So yeah, but I like the respectful conversations. That's a new one for me. So I'm gonna take that away.
Critical thinking and respectful conversations. Yeah. I think it's a big advantage.
I completely agree, and done lots of the grunt work as well over the years, so I completely understand what that feels like.
I've never understood why you would ignore the point of view of the 23-year-old you've just employed as a grad. Like, they come out with some really good stuff. Like,
100%.
The problem is that you've dismissed them as the one that's meant to just be bringing in the coffee and doing the photocopying, and it's just it's no way to treat colleagues.
No, and I've personally had a project where twice a year I'll just pick like 10 kind of random people in the business and have a conversation, like what's going well, what's not going well, what would you do tomorrow if you were me? And getting that really diverse perspective across the business has been such a helpful thing for me to get, because you're not always speaking to these people, or they're new starts or fresh out of uni or apprentices. All of these people have like brilliant insight about the business because they're living and breathing it every day, whereas you can get quite far removed from some of the jobs that they're doing that you used to do, and actually you don't have any idea about that anymore, but they have really, really great ideas about how to move the business forward and make it much stronger. So yeah, hugely value that time.
I love that. Those opinions. More of that in business. Really nice.
Okay, so lastly then, maybe for those 23-year-olds who are just getting started on their career or anybody else, what is the one piece of advice that you would pass on to anybody going into marketing, in marketing, that you feel would be useful for you in that type of career?
Read as much as possible, not just the popular stuff, but actually get really, really into understanding how marketing works, understanding how people think. Psychology is as important in marketing as anything else. So I think reading as much as possible, understanding the human condition, remembering it's humans making decisions, and that kind of real, almost like anthropological study, I think is really, really key to being able to connect with customers humanly, but also being able to understand that you're moving minds, you're moving bodies of people, huge groups of people as a marketer. So it also gives you the discipline of being able to like measure the impact that thinking can have. We're not here to hit a number. We're here to sell to a group of people, and really understanding how that happens on a data level, on a human level, on a psychological level. Like, be the generalist, especially early in your career. Have the generalist and use the fact that you probably don't have the 1,001 other things pulling on your time in your 20s, that you can take some time out to fill your brain and become, like, you don't have to be expert at one thing at that age. You could be generally very good. And I think generally very good is the way forward. And then you can work out what you specialize on.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. And it really just helps you join the dots sometimes in a later conversation. You know, when you're talking about something like, oh, I read this thing, or I was in that meeting, or I saw this thing. And I think that generalist approach at the beginning serves you really well throughout your career, because things pop up that you've got like a little bit of knowledge on. But it helps you maybe read the room a bit better. So, yeah.
Also, great just advice. Career survival. If you've done a bit of everything, you'll never be out of work. And that's in longevity in marketing is underrated. You can make an awful lot of money in 3 years and not for the next 10. So stick around. Don't try and like burn out too early, but stick around. And actually, it's a lovely business to be in. Really interesting, really human, really rewarding.
Yeah. Hear, hear. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolutely brilliant conversation. I've actually taken loads of notes as you're talking. So yeah, lots that was very, very helpful for me as well. So thank you so much for your time, and yeah, have a wonderful day.
You too. Thanks for having me.